Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is part two of our conversation with Positive Conclusions. Part one was last episode, and here we go.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just talking off the top of my head. There was a case yesterday. It wasn't in the family courts, but of the rape victim who was found to have hit herself with a hammer to make false allegations. And that,
I mean, that was a Supreme Court, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that caused suicide attempts and death threats on the family of the accused. Absolutely horrendous. But the outcome was, I think it was an 8-year jail sentence. That's a court taking false allegations seriously, and they certainly should be, because the effects on just the accused, but also the family of the accused and the friends of the accused, it can be horrendous. And so that case, we see that false allegations are being taken seriously.
That case is really interesting, though, because I know it's not family court. We're kind of digressing a little bit, but that case is really interesting for me, because there's clear CCTV that they've shown now on the news for buying a hammer. And there's also clear CCTV of her going into a hotel with nobody else going into that hotel with her. And she's gone to the police and said that these men assaulted her in a hotel. Now, they must have had that CCTV. The police must have had access to that CCTV not too long after she'd made these allegations. Yet they still pushed for these men to go to jail. And one of them was in jail for like 90 days or something. I can't remember how long, to be honest. But one of them was behind bars for quite a while. And like, you've got to see, it takes days to get CCTV, maybe a week to get CCTV footage. They should have knocked it on the head straight away as soon as they saw that CCTV, but they don't. They continue it, and it's not until it goes through court and then she gets found guilty because of this CCTV. It should have been, they should have just, the police didn't handle that very well, because it got worse and worse and worse because of the delays. And then there was a movement behind her. There was a movement behind her, and there was hatred about these abusive men, which didn't even exist. But that wouldn't have happened if straight away we knew that she was lying, because we had video evidence. But that was kept quiet because it was evidence not to be talked about, because it was a criminal proceedings. I mean, maybe that's something that needs to be looked at.
Yeah, it's a strange case. I think quite a few police forces are in special measures at the moment, including the Metropolitan Police in London. I mean, there's all sorts of, and this stories about how many police officers have abuse allegations made against them, and today I read a story of a lot of them are dropped, and you don't know whether they're dropped fairly or unfairly, false allegations or not. But obviously the police are going through a challenging time at the moment, but that's perhaps we could do another episode on that another time.
Digress a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. As a society, this false allegations is interesting. It is relevant, because to see it taken seriously in an English court is really good to see. But is that ever going to filter through to the family? Because the family court seems to be a law unto itself, pardon the pun.
I mean, I think this is probably just a one-off random case, to be honest, and because there was such clear video evidence of it, and it's quite a strange case. I mean, who hits himself in the face with a hammer? That's kind of weird, isn't it? So, and also had such devastating impact to the men that she'd accused as well. And it wasn't just the fact that they were just random men, it was a community as well. So there was a lot of racist attacks because of it as well. So I think if it might just be an isolated case, but there are loads of other cases where men have been terribly abused. There was another case I put on my Twitter not that long ago about a man that had been abused by his wife, and she ended up going to jail. It does happen, and I think maybe it is happening slightly more than it used to happen, but that doesn't negate the fact that society as a whole generally sees, if you think of domestic abuse, you're thinking of a wife beater, you know.
Yes,
you're not
yes.
thinking necessarily the fact, you know, the man might actually be the victim. And interestingly, in 2005, a person called May Chahal and Corson, as two people, did some research, and they found that mothers were more likely than fathers to be responsible for physical abuse. And the DHHS data in the UK, between 2001 and 2006, children abused by one parent were 70.6% mothers, 29.4% were by fathers. Now, this is just data that I've got. Other people can do their own research, but I personally am of the belief that females are no less likely to be abusive than males in relationships. Now, the abuse may look different. You know, they may use different tactics, or they may just not necessarily cause as severe injuries, maybe because they're not as generally in a population as big as strong, and maybe male victims are able to withstand more of a barrage of abuse just because they're physically bigger and stronger. Also, there may be the fact that men just wouldn't want to go to the hospital saying that their wife had beaten them because they've got their own male pride and stuff. But I mean, personally, I feel that if it's not completely equal, it's much, much closer than people believe. And
I would
even suggest there's potential that females abuse male partners a lot more than males abuse female partners. Not as severely, because we hear about female victims of domestic abuse being murdered a lot more frequently.
Yes.
And I wouldn't dispute that. However, there's research out there that shows that women hit their male partners a lot more and admit to it than males hit their female partners. So it's a complicated issue, but I feel like it's dangerous to presume that the male is always going to be the abusive party and the female is always going to be the victim. And also, we haven't even spoken about non-reciprocal domestic abuse and reciprocal domestic abuse, because that's also very interesting, because non-reciprocal domestic violence is when you've got one person that's just abusing the other parent, the other party, and that's much, much higher for female abusers. There's far fewer men that do that. Whereas reciprocal domestic abuse is where one party's maybe hit one and the other one whacks them back. And you find that men and women, that's more like 50-50. However, if you think, let's say a female has whacked a male and then the male then punches them back, it's going to probably put the woman in hospital, isn't it? Whereas if it was the other way around, whereas a man pushed a woman and then she slapped him, he's not going to go to hospital, is he? So obviously, all forms of physical assault are completely wrong. However, it's important to note that where there is cases of domestic violence, it is both males and females. And if you look at same-sex relationships, the highest percentage of domestic violence is female same-sex relationships. The lowest is male same-sex relationships. And that's dreadful, because the victims of female same-sex relationships have no support out there. There's no support for female victims of same-sex relationships. That means there's no support for male same-sex domestic abuse survivors, really, either. It just seems to be for female often female mothers get all the support, because that's what refuge is for, really, isn't it? And so I think a lot needs to be done to change the narrative, because I believe the narrative is a false narrative, that it's always males that are the abusive ones. Anybody can be abusive. I mean, if you understand people and humans as a species, you understand that we've got choice and everyone's capable of being abusive. Everyone's capable of being kind and nice and empathetic. Gender's got nothing to do with that.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's got nothing. That's why it's really good to see men and women fighting against parental alienation. And, you know, you mentioned grandparents earlier, that there's so many grandmothers, Match Mothers supports them. There's so many grandmothers that are alienated from their grandchildren and grandfathers. And to see, when, you know, one of the things on my journey that's been really positive is seeing, you know, men and women actually come together to be on the same side against the abusive behaviour that's you see in the family courts. And it just isn't. I mean, I know outcomes may tilt in one direction or another sometimes, but I think, as we said at the beginning, it's the behavior. All abuse is wrong, and it's the behavior that is the enemy. It's not a gender issue. It really, at the heart of it, you know, men and women need to be on the same side here against that, because it's the children that are most important, and whoever the abusive parent is in the wrong. It's just not, you know, it's just not a mother or a father or a male or female thing. But it can play out that way. I've seen people who have been through the family courts, and they have a very gender-based view of things. But I just don't think that's right. You know, I think if we're going to move as a society to a better place, as in other movements as well, you've got to do it in an equal way, and you know, regardless of, you know, whatever the movement is, race or gender or whatever, you've got to say this behaviour is wrong, whatever it is. As a society, we're going to change it, and we don't care what colour you are, what gender you are, whatever.
That's the key, isn't it? Is this behaviour is wrong? It's not. You see all of these like posters on the trains and on the buses and stuff, and it'll be like, if he's doing this, it's wrong. And it's like, it's all gender specific. It's all the man, if this man's doing that or if that man's doing that, it's the behavior. It's not the fact that they're male. You know,
it is going back to what we talked about at the beginning, that the gender in this arena of abuse, and what we're talking about today with the budget, childcare and the family court, in those areas, we are behind, and people do have a gender-based narrative too often, where if it was a racial situation or a...
It could be completely different, sexuality. Wouldn't it? I mean, you couldn't have a poster on a bus that said, it's got a picture of a man staring and says, if he's staring at you, it's domestic abuse, you can call his number, you know?
Yeah.
You couldn't do that with somebody's race or religion or anything else. And so is it domestic abuse if a woman's staring at me? If I phone up the transport police and say that there's a woman across the other side and she keeps staring at me and looking at me and smiling at me, is that domestic abuse? What are they going to take that seriously?
I'm guessing not.
And what happens? What happens if you've got a social communication disorder?
Yeah.
And you don't know how to look at somebody, because a lot of people have got autism, for instance, and they don't know. They might see somebody's got a really nice hat that they're wearing, and they're like, that's their favorite color. They keep looking at the hat, and they could go on a sex offenders register because they've been looking at some person's green hat.
Yeah,
it's funny, but it's not funny. Yeah,
I do feel like that's a difficult one. When you're talking about staring, it's like, I get why they're saying that they don't want people to be leching at other people. But it's, if you go into public, there's cameras everywhere.
Yeah.
You can't stop cameras looking at you. So how can you stop somebody's eyes looking at you?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of going back to, you know, where somebody gets cancelled for using the wrong pronouns or gets criticised. And it's similar here with what you're talking about on, you know, on the tube. It's, you can't really legislate down to that micro level. It, because the important thing in all sorts of speech and human interaction is context. And it's the intention of the person. And you can't make a blanket law, as you say, to know whether a stare, you know, what the intention is of a stare, you know.
Yeah, it would be better if there was a poster that said something along the lines of, if you look at somebody for too long, that might make them feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Well, you're educating somebody then, aren't you?
Yeah.
Rather than pointing a finger at all men, saying that all men are the problem. For women feeling like they're being looked at too much. Actually, hold on. Just educate people not to look at people for too long because they might not like it.
Yes. Yes, I agree. Yeah. But we could, we could do a whole episode on public advertising and sort of the nudging that goes on from the government and all sorts of poster campaigns and that nowadays. But that's probably that's a different side issue.
There was an interesting thing I was thinking of today, actually, when I was walking home from work. It was, if there's a problem, and you get government funding to fix that problem, if you create that problem and make it bigger, you'll get more funding for it.
Yes. I mean, a lot of these groups, it's not in their interest to cure the problem, is it?
That's another paradox. There, it's like, how do we stop that from happening? So let's say Women's Aid, for instance, they get so much millions of funding because of the problem with domestic abuse. Ultimately, isn't it? That's what they support. If they suddenly turned around and said, well, actually, there isn't any domestic abuse, they wouldn't get any money, would they? So they have to continue. I'm not saying there isn't domestic abuse. There clearly is. But I'm just saying that in order for them to get more and more funding every year, domestic abuse needs to get higher and worse and worse and worse. So they have to keep spreading that message that men are a problem, women are victims. Otherwise, they risk the possibility that funding may get less.
Yeah, I mean, certainly with legal aid solicitors, that's the case. I mean, the thing with solicitors, you know, they're an example of, you know, they don't really want the family court to repair or to reform. I mean, how many solicitors have you heard of that are campaigning for change?
Not many. There are a few, but there's not many.
There are a few.
There's a few that are, and most of them, I know a couple of them through Families Need Fathers, so they support in Families Need Fathers groups and stuff. There are some, but not many.
But you think these people must. I mean, we've seen misery in the family courts. You think these people must see it every day? They must see the same lies, the same abuse, the same conning of judges, etc. How can they see that and the misery it causes to parents and children every day?
I guess for them.
They don't feel motivated to do anything.
I guess it's like a show for them. They go there and they make money. It's almost like a pantomime for them.
But that sounds so terrible. I don't want to believe that because it's just that sounds so horrendous.
Well, I can't possibly imagine that. I can't comprehend a situation where a family law solicitor is really putting the child's best interests at heart, yet they're making thousands of pounds out of them by stopping them from seeing their other parent. That doesn't compute with me. So the only way I can understand it is if they don't have the empathy for the child.
I can see that. I don't want to believe it. But
I mean, they don't ever have to meet the child, do they? So,
well, this is it. This is the thing. They're a very detached bunch. I've had multiple solicitors in my case. now, they don't seem to ever ask, "Oh, how's the child?" You know, can we see some photos of the child? They don't. Can we meet the child? they don't care. You know, it's just
It's just paperwork to them, and they get their money by doing paperwork, by sending emails and doing paperwork. That's how they get their money. And the majority of them have found out that they can get a lot more money if they drag proceedings on. I mean, actually, in the family courts, if you've got two parents that are both self-representing, the statistics on the government website will show you that their final hearing will come a lot quicker than if you've got a party that's got a legal representation. So that really just goes to show, like, well, why are cases going on longer if you've got legal representation?
That's very interesting. If you could send me a link to that research, I'd really like to
see it. It's on the government website. It's on the government statistics. I'll locate it for you. I'll locate it for you, yeah. It's not can't remember exactly where it is, but I will find it for you and I'll send it to you.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, we'll include that in the show notes. I mean, but then you think, well, what motivates a solicitor to go into family law? They could go into any sort of law. And you sort of think, well, my first thought is, well, they must go in there wanting to help families or maybe.
I don't know about that. I'd imagine that it's a lot more difficult to get into criminal law. I'm not sure because I've never studied law before, but I'd imagine it's more difficult to make money in criminal law than it would be in family law, because I guess you have to be really good at your job in criminal law, because you're having to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt, aren't you?
Yeah, but this is it. I don't want to believe the implications of what we're saying of how that would make me see most family solicitors. I don't want to believe they're like that, but I want to believe they go into the. But maybe I'm just.
I mean, yeah, but you probably believed, like, before you ever entered into the family court system, you probably believed that the UK was a fair and equal country, and that you probably felt that you had the right to a fair trial in the UK, because it's a human right in most countries to have the right to a fair trial. But then you stepped into the UK secret family courts and realised actually the UK does not abide by that human right. You don't have the right to a fair trial in UK family courts if your ex-partner has been granted legal aid and gets a legal aid solicitor because they've made allegations of domestic abuse.
Yes.
And you have to pay for your solicitor. And if you can't afford to pay for your solicitor, you're going to have to defend yourself. How is that a fair trial?
Well, that's the situation I'm in. Even after the fact find, where they found that the mother was abusive and alienating, the only consequence of that so far has been that she got legal aid after she was found guilty. So, and as I mentioned, we had court hearings last year to do with a holiday, which she was legally aided for, and so had no consequence. She could just say, I don't want him to go on holiday. I then had to pay for a barrister until I ran out of money. And so we're now left with the final hearing, and I'm not sure if I can afford a barrister for that. It's a 4-day hearing. But the mother who was found guilty of abuse, she's got a top London legally aided barrister going to be coming at me.
How can Peter get legal aid if she's been found not to?
How did she get legal aid? I really don't know, and neither does my barrister who was working for me, and I hoped to afford for the final hearing, but he doesn't know how she got it. And
I think the problem is with legal aid, to get legal aid, you don't need any proof of domestic abuse. Not solid proof of domestic abuse. I'm not sure how she's still got it, but I'm presuming that she's just managed to find a law firm that are just going to continue just winging it.
Maybe she's made fresh allegations that I don't know about. Maybe she's gone to the police again. I don't know. But the thing is, there's not a mechanism in place where we can find out. Because it's between her and the legal aid authority.
Yeah, and it's not your business, is it?
No.
It's only your business when you're up against a barrister in court.
Yeah, it's my business exactly. I'm on the receiving end of, I mean, again, and you use the word business, and it is a business in many respects. That barrister, yeah. Her barrister, before she got legal aid, there was a short 30-minute hearing once, and her barrister did pro bono for that 30 minutes, knowing full well that if they were successful at that hearing, legal aid, the gravy train would be pulling up at the station to pick them up, and that's exactly what happened. So the barrister did 30 minutes for free and has then got, you know, the best part of a year's legal aid following that. So it is a business for
them. A free ticket for them, isn't it?
Yeah. And again, the other parent, I don't want to keep talking about my case, but it I'm sure lots of us are going through this. The other parent keeps saying, "Oh, talk to my solicitors," and I never point it out, but they're not her solicitors. They're my solicitors I used to have are not my solicitors. They're in it for themselves, I believe. I'm coming round to this, but I don't want to believe it. But I'm sure that having read the fact-find judgment, her solicitors know she's guilty, and they know she's abusing me and alienating the child, and they know the outcomes of that aren't going to be good, but they're still her solicitors because they're getting paid very highly legal aid rates. So they're not, and whether she wins or loses in the final hearing, the solicitors will win. They don't care really if she loses.
So, oh, no, they still get the money.
Yeah, so when she often says, "Oh, talk to my solicitors," as if they're on her side. They kind of are, in that they'll argue for her, but if she loses, they're going to, as soon as that final hearing's finished, they're going to ride off into the distance with their sack of money, and she won't hear from them again, you know.
Oh, no. And also, like, any cases that they lose or don't do so well in, they just get filed into the bottom of the pile. It's not like it goes against them in any way. It's only the cases, the tricky cases that they can win, that's the ones that they then stick on their website to show how great they are as a solicitor, because we won this case. And then all they need to do is win a few cases, and that will be the ones that they stick on as their advertisement.
Yes.
They may have lost like hundreds of other cases, but who cares? They still got the money.
Well, that's a good point. I don't know if there are any sort of Trustpilot equivalents for solicitors. But
no, because the family courts are private, aren't they? So you wouldn't really be able to have that. And also, you wouldn't see, for the same reason, you wouldn't be able to see, this solicitor wins 60% of their cases, this solicitor wins 80% of their cases, this solicitor wins 30% of their cases. I mean, if you had that statistic, then they would be desperately trying to win because they'd want their percentage to go up, wouldn't they? But all they really care about is they get your money. If they win a really tricky case, that can go on their on their website. But I mean, I'm a little bit sceptical about family lawyers, but then that's probably because I've been through the system.
I mean, I find myself talking as if I am sceptical sometimes. I've done it just now in the last 10, 15 minutes with you. I've at one point I've said, well, I don't want to believe they're like that. And then I've gone off and described exactly how they are like that. And I do find myself split. It's the difference between the way you wish it was and reality, you know.
What I'd say is one of the reasons I find it hard to believe that that they have much empathy, many of these lawyers, is because there's so many of them across the country, yet none of them, there's no charity. None of them are charities.
No.
And that makes me feel like, you know, if you've got an industry and you're trying to do something good for society, and you've got the skills to do that, it might be one person that would be doing it for free.
Yeah.
As a charity. But there isn't one. I've never found one. The closest I've found to that would be, I think there's one. There's a charity called Dads Unlimited, but the barristers and the solicitors aren't the charity. The charity funds the barristers and the solicitors, so they're still getting paid. So there's not. I don't know any barrister or solicitor that works for free.
I think there are some pro bono organisations. Somebody told me about one or two of them. But I don't know any details about them or how active they are.
Yeah, I've never heard of them. I'd be interested to find out who they are and what services they provide.
Yeah.
But it is one of those things because I've helped quite a few people, mostly through Families Meet Fathers, but I've never charged anyone. People have asked me to be Mackenzie Friend. I generally say, look, what I'll do is I'll support you however I can. I won't charge you anything, but I won't be an official Mackenzie Friend. I've got another job, you know. I mean, it's hard enough doing my current job and having a life, you know. But I would never charge anybody for anything I do. And there are no other Mackenzie Friends that don't charge a thing, but most do. And I feel like this, even as a Mackenzie Friend or somebody that gives support, I feel like, why should I charge people when all I'm doing is trying to protect children? That should be a free. That's a free thing that I do. I mean, the most important thing for me is that the child gets access to both their parents if they're safe. And if that means I take 10 minutes out of my life, an hour out of my life, or however long out of my life, if I'm helping a person to get access to their child, as long as they're safe, obviously, or helping a person to become more safe so that they can be in their child's life, then I think that's invaluable. It's worth more than any kind of money.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's many solicitors out there that think like that. It's a profession.
No.
I mean, I personally feel like family law or family courts should be free for everyone. It's such an important part of society that you must get right. And I don't think people should have to pay to do it. I don't think it should necessarily even be court like this. It should be done in the mediation phase. It shouldn't get to court.
Yes.
And everything should be done to ensure that there's a decision made in a mediation phase that's for the best interest of the child, with other professionals involved, to make sure that the child does have access, safe access to both their parents. I just think the family courts are a waste of space, to be honest.
Yes, it's hard to argue against that.
I give. One piece of advice I'd give to anyone that's got children or anyone thinks about having any children, if they ever separate from the mother or the father, basically, if you have any form of physical contact with your child, don't go to family court. It's just not worth it. If you're seeing your child like every other Saturday, and you feel like, oh, I'd like to, you know, see them, you know, every other Saturday and Sunday, it's not worth going to family court, because you could end up spending 3 years not seeing your child at all.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened to me, actually. It's like, actually, it gets a hell of a lot worse going through family court before it ever starts getting any better. And you're flipping a coin as to where we'll ever get any better than what it was before you went to family court.
Yes, it could get worse, as you say.
Could get worse, could be the same, or could just get fractionally better. But you'll also never know whether it could have got better naturally anyway, without going to family court. I mean, the other parent may, the resident parent may have decided to hold on, this is too much for me anyway, I need a break. I'll let them go and see their other parent now. So, I mean, ultimately, the resident parent's got all control. That's what I've learned. They've got all the control. Unless you can change who the resident parent is, which very, very, very rarely happens, and it usually would only happen if you've got concrete evidence that the other parent's not safe, and that's and go through family courts and they've agreed that that's the case. Very, very rarely do you get a change of residency, and as we know, the resident parent, what they say is basically gospel, so you just have to kind of go along with whatever they say anyway, regardless of whatever court order ever happens. I mean, if you've got a court order that says that you see your child on the Wednesday, and the resident parent says they're not well today, so you can't see them, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's nothing you can do at all. And you mentioned about like enforcement orders earlier. I think only 1% of family court child arrangements are enforceable by the police, because they've gone back to court and got them enforced. 1% of that. So basically, if your contact is not working because the resident parents, you know, decided that they don't want you to have contact, then it's just not going to happen, unless you then go back to court for another year or so, 2 years maybe, to get your enforcement. I don't know how long it takes. It'd probably take over a year to get it enforced. You'd have to prove that the other parent had breached the order several times.
Yep.
And then... And then what happens if she says the child's sick, but you've got an enforcement order? Are the police going to go in and enforce it when she said the child's sick? Probably not, because if the child's sick, it's in the child's best interest to be in bed anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really tricky, especially if the child's been like 5 years with the resident parent and they have been alienating them and they don't want to go and see their other parent.
Yeah.
How can you stop it?
No, it's very difficult. I mean, it is good to see other countries starting to look at parental alienation more seriously. For example, I saw online that Brazil treats it as a criminal offence now.
I'm not sure if you saw, though, that the World Health Organization were trying to clap back at that.
No.
Have you not seen that? Yeah, World Health Organization were condemning Brazil for that decision. So I think that's a kind of, it just goes to show how strong feminism is in world politics. It's basically, it's in every single aspect of it. It's basically controls the World Health Organization, it controls the UK government, it controls the European governments. It's difficult to go against it. And when you've got a government like in Brazil that don't listen to the West and they make their own decisions, that's when you hear things like the World Health Organization saying, hold on, you can't do that. But actually, no, they're right. It is categorically possible for one parent to emotionally abuse another parent to such an extent that they're too scared to go and see their other parent.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that anyone could deny that that's possible is ludicrous. Of course it's possible.
Well, and again, it's not a gender thing, because men can do it can turn children against mothers.
Men do it just as much as women. I think the fact is in the UK, and probably in some other Western countries, is if you've been through the family court systems in those countries, the resident parent is usually the mother, so it's a lot harder for a man to alienate their children
from
the mother, just because in those cases they've got less contact to be able to do that. But but certainly they're just as capable, and they probably do it just as frequently as mothers do.
Yes.
Okay, so if just in closing then, thanks very much for coming on the podcast, and I really enjoyed our conversation, and would you be able to either send me some links that I can include in the show notes or
I mean I can say them so you got them on air as well, but I'll also send it to you in the Twitter as well, so you've got them. So so our Facebook is just Positive Conclusions. You can find us on Facebook there. Our Twitter is at Positive Conclude. So we didn't have the whole word of conclusions because it didn't let us have that many characters. So it's Positive Conclu.
Okay.
And Instagram is Positive_Conclusions.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Family Court Reform Coalition's website is fcrc.uk.
Yes.
And the website for Positive Conclusions is positiveconclusions.org.uk. And our email address is info@positiveconclusions.org.uk as well.
Well, that's fantastic. I'll put those in the show notes. Thanks very much for coming on the podcast. And best wishes for your work in trying to bring about change.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and hopefully we'll speak again soon.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.